Lincoln, Disc 27.
That kind of talk, of course, made the problem of Reconstruction a part of the contest for the next presidential race. From time to time during the previous year, there'd been talk of re-electing Lincoln in 1864, but for the most part, it had been desultory and not particularly fervent. Republican newspaper editors, when the question of a second term was raised, usually combined praise for Lincoln with commendation of other conceivable Republican presidential candidates, Seward, Chase, Banks, Butler, Fremont, and so on. Lincoln tried to think as little as possible about the 1864 election. Nowhere in his letters or his public papers during the first 2.5 years of the war did he mention renomination or re-election. When newspapers began to agitate the issue, he remarked testily, "I wish they'd stop thrusting that subject of the presidency into my face. I don't want to hear anything about it." But for all the burdens of his office, he did desire re-election. As he remarked later, he viewed a second term not as just a personal compliment, but as an expression of the people's belief that he could better finish a difficult work than could anyone less severely schooled to the task. By the fall of 1863, when E.B. Washburn asked Lincoln to let some of his confidential friends know his intentions with regard to the next presidential election, he answered, with only a minimum of tentativeness, "A second term would be a great honor and a great labor, which together perhaps I'd not decline if tendered." By November he was more open, and an Illinois visitor who talked with him in the White House reported, "He'll be a candidate again, if his friends so desire, of course." There was little that Lincoln could do openly to promote his renomination and re-election. Custom prohibited him from soliciting support, making public statements, or appearing to campaign for office. But as the nominating season approached, he made a point of hosting numerous social activities at the White House. Both the Lincolns were resolved to make the winter of 1863-64 a brilliant social season, which could only boost the president's hopes for a second term. Mary Lincoln willingly cooperated in promoting her husband's re-election. Her mental and physical health had improved, and she gained greater control over her emotions when she was obliged to contrast her own problems with those of her youngest half-sister, Emily Todd Helm, whose husband, Confederate General Benjamin Hardin Helm, was killed at Chickamauga. Seeking to return from the Deep South to her home in Kentucky, Emily was passed through the Union lines in December and sought refuge in the White House. The Lincolns tried to keep her visit a secret because the presence of the widow of a high-ranking Confederate officer in the White House was a potential source of embarrassment, especially since Emily remained outspoken in her loyalty to the South. Inevitably, the news leaked out, and General Daniel Sickles, who'd lost a leg in the Battle of Gettysburg, told the president, "You shouldn't have that rebel in your house." Firmly, Lincoln responded, "General Sickles, my wife and I are in the habit of choosing our own guests. We don't need from our friends either advice or assistance in the matter." After a week, with a pass from the president allowing her to cross the army lines, Emily left for Kentucky. Inspirited by Emily's visit, Mary shed her depressing mourning clothing and appeared at the White House New Year's Day reception in a purple dress trimmed with black velvet. The president wore a long black coat, which, an English observer noted, seemed to hang on him. With more enthusiasm than they'd displayed for many months, both the president and his wife greeted the visitors who thronged the White House. At this reception, For the first time in American history, the guests presented to the president included what one newspaper described as four colored men of genteel exterior and with the manners of gentlemen. As each visitor was introduced, the president shook hands and bowed, usually saying only, "Good morning, Mr. Jones," or, "Mr. Smith, how do you do?" Occasionally, he paused to exchange a few words with an old friend. Once, when a woman asked whether these receptions weren't hard work, he replied, "Oh, no, no. Of course, this is tiresome physically, but I'm pretty strong. And it rests me, after all, for here nobody's cross or exacting, and no man asks me for what I can't give him." In addition to receptions, the Lincolns gave a number of dinner parties, to which political friends and possible supporters were invited. Fiercely loyal, Mary wanted to exclude her husband's rivals, and when Nicolay came up with a guest list for the annual cabinet dinner on January 14th, she struck off Chase, his daughter Kate, and his son-in-law William Sprague. Nicolay appealed to the president, who ordered the names restored. "There soon arose such a rampage as the White House hasn't seen for a year," Nicolay reported. And Mary, whom the secretary referred to as Her Satanic Majesty, announced that she was going to take charge of all the arrangements for the dinner. Finding that she was unable to manage, she summoned Nicolay on the very afternoon of the dinner, apologized to him, and asked his help. "I think," reported the young secretary smugly, "she's felt happier since she cast out that devil of stubbornness." Both the Lincolns gave particular attention to Charles Sumner, who'd shown a disturbing tendency during the previous summer to oppose the administration's policies. Lincoln respected Sumner for his knowledge, his sacrifices in the anti-slavery cause, and his seriousness of purpose, and as they became better acquainted, found the man behind the cold and haughty senatorial mask. Sumner and Lincoln, Mary said, used to talk and laugh together like two schoolboys. Mary found the handsome bachelor senator equally attractive, and they became fast friends. They wrote each other notes in French. They went for carriage drives, and they lent each other books. He let her read his correspondence from European notables, and she sent him bouquets from the White House conservatory. The senator, Mary recalled later, was a constant visitor at the White House, both in office and drawing room. He appreciated my noble husband, and I learned to converse with him with more freedom and confidence than any of my other friends. No doubt a good deal of calculation lay behind the attentions that Sumner received from the White House, for the president realized that the senator was a powerful force in the extreme abolitionist wing of his party. But Lincoln knew that it was going to take more than White House receptions or bouquets for Charles Sumner to assure his re-election. No president since Andrew Jackson had served a second term, and within the Republican Party there was considerable sentiment in favor of rotation in office, especially among those opposed to Lincoln. He could readily identify several groups of such opponents. The most vocal were abolitionists, mostly in New England, but also powerful in the West, who feared he might negotiate a peace that didn't completely eradicate slavery. Typical was an Iowa caucus of abolitionists that condemned the president as an insignificant man who had clogged and impeded the wheels and movements of the revolution. Moreover, because he was a Kentuckian by birth, and his brothers-in-law being in the rebel army, he had always shielded the rebels. German Americans were also disaffected. Many thought that Lincoln, together with Stanton, and especially Halleck, was at heart a nativist who discriminated against German-born generals like Franz Sigel, and Carl Schurz. As the prominent Indiana Freie Presse said, "We cannot and dare not vote for Lincoln unless we are willing to participate in the betrayal of the Republic, unless we're willing to remain, for all future, the most despicable stepchildren of the nation." The charcoal, or radical, faction of Missouri Republicans was especially hostile, believing that the president had shabbily rejected their overtures of friendship. In nearly every northern state, Lincoln's re-election was opposed by one or more factions within the Republican Party. Sometimes these factions continued the rivalry between former Whigs and former Democrats. In other states, they reflected nothing more than intense personal rivalries. Thus, in New York, one faction consisted of the supporters of Seward and Thurlow Weed, who seemed to be the principal beneficiaries of the appointments and contracts given by the Lincoln administration. The other, which clustered around Greeley and David Dudley Field, was usually critical of the president. In Maryland, an intense struggle between the Blairs and Henry Winter Davis continued. When Lincoln sustained his postmaster general, Davis became one of the president's most articulate and vituperative enemies. In most cases, dissatisfaction with the president didn't derive from fundamental ideological differences. Virtually all Republicans agreed that the war must be fought until victory, that slavery had to be abolished, and that some conditions had to be imposed on the southern states before they could be readmitted to the Union. But there was disagreement over Lincoln's ability to attain these goals. Many considered him an ineffectual administrator, who tolerated looseness and inefficiency throughout the government. The best evidence was that, after 2.5 years of costly, bloody warfare, the 20 million loyal citizens of the North were unable to overcome 5 million rebellious white Southerners. Republican members of Congress, who were in the best position to observe the workings of the administration, gave little support for Lincoln's renomination. The chairman of the most important Senate committees, such as Henry Wilson of Massachusetts, chairman of the Military Affairs Committee, Benjamin F. Wade of Ohio, chairman of the Committee on Territories, Zachariah Chandler of Michigan, chairman of the Commerce Committee, and James W. Grimes of Iowa, chairman of the Committee on the District of Columbia, were openly opposed to a second term. And only careful management kept Sumner, who headed the Foreign Relations Committee, from joining the opposition. Republican leaders in the House of Representatives were also mostly hostile to Lincoln. Early in 1864, when a visiting editor asked Thaddeus Stevens to introduce him to some congressmen who favored Lincoln's renomination, the Pennsylvania congressman brought him to Representative Isaac N. Arnold of Illinois, explaining, "Here's a man who wants to find a Lincoln member of Congress. You're the only one I know, and I've come over to introduce my friend to you." Aware of this congressional dissatisfaction, Lincoln and his friends took solace in the belief that it was shared by only a few disgruntled politicians. Surely the mass of the people thought differently, and his supporters convinced themselves that there was a widespread and constantly increasing concurrence of sentiment in favor of the re-election of Mr. Lincoln. "Mr. Lincoln has the inside track," announced the Chicago Tribune. "He has the confidence of the people, and even the respect and affections of the masses." Lincoln's mail was filled with repeated assurances of the support of the voters. "Acting upon your own convictions, irrespective of those who threaten, as well as of those who fawn and flatter," wrote a Bostonian, "you've touched and taken the popular heart. and secured your re-election beyond a peradventure should you desire it. Especially heartening were the expressions of support from the Army. "The soldier will trust no one but Abraham Lincoln," announced one veteran in the Army of the Potomac. "I believe it's God's purpose to call Abraham Lincoln again to the presidential chair." Such letters encouraged Lincoln's managers to present him in the role of an outsider who had the support of the people, if not the politicians. In several states, union meetings begged the president to become the people's candidate for re-election, accepting the nomination so generously tendered without awaiting a nomination from a Republican National Convention. Nowhere was this movement stronger than in New York City, where a National Conference Committee of the Union Lincoln Association, headed by the wealthy Simeon Draper, urged the people throughout the nation to meet on February 22nd and express their support for Lincoln's re-election. The Democratic New York World thought it reasonably certain that Lincoln would nominate himself and leave the Republican convention, if there should be one, nothing to do but hold a ratification meeting. That prospect helped to mobilize Lincoln's opponents within the Republican Party. But to have any chance of success, they needed a rival candidate. Some looked to General Grant. Others thought of Benjamin F. Butler, famous for his severity during the occupation of New Orleans. But Lincoln largely neutralized him by giving him a dead-end job as commander at Fort Monroe. John C. Fremont had backers as well, both because he was known to hate Lincoln and because he had substantial support among the Germans and the radicals, especially in Missouri. But in the winter of 1863-64, most rested their hopes on Salmon P. Chase. Chase's disaffection with the administration of which he was part had steadily increased since his embarrassing role in the cabinet crisis of December 1862. Though he and Lincoln had developed an effective working relationship, they weren't personally congenial. Chase was stiff, reserved, and ponderous. In the course of a general conversation, he was given to uttering profundities like, "It is singularly instructive to meet so often as we do in life and in history instances of vaulting ambition, meanness, and treachery, failing after enormous exertions, and integrity and honesty march straight in triumph to its purpose." He resented the easygoing relationship Lincoln had established with Seward. The president often made impromptu evening visits to Seward's home to pass along the latest news and gossip, or to share his most recent joke. But he never thought of dropping in on Chase. But there was more to it than that. Chase's discontent stemmed fundamentally from his conviction that he was superior to Lincoln, both as a statesman and as an administrator. Chase also felt that his labors in the Treasury Department were unappreciated. His exhausting efforts to borrow money and raise taxes in order to finance the war seemed to go unnoticed. Chase especially resented the president's decentralized administrative policy of allowing each cabinet officer to run his own department without interference or even consultation with his colleagues. What was at stake here was not just Chase's power drive. It was his sense that he was the only one responsible for keeping the government's financial tub filled, while the war, navy, and other departments controlled the spigots that drained it. He was willing to admit that the president had always treated him with kindness, and he didn't doubt Lincoln's fairness or integrity of purpose. But he believed Lincoln's policies toward the South and slavery were too slow and too cautious. The secretary was determined that the end of the war must bring about unconditional and immediate emancipation in all the rebel states. No retrograde from the proclamation of emancipation, no recognition of a rebel state as part of the Union, or any terms with it except on the extinction, wholly, at once and forever, of slavery. Repeatedly, he prodded the president to extend his Emancipation Proclamation to areas in the South under Union military control, which Lincoln had accepted. Increasingly, he came to share Sumner's belief that the only true Unionists in the South were the blacks, and he favored the participation of colored Loyalists in the reconstruction of the rebellious states. Lincoln was aware of these dissatisfactions of his Secretary of the Treasury. For the most part, Chase openly and honorably expressed his dissents, and the President made no complaint about them. Nor did he object when Chase sought to make the army of Treasury Department employees a force greatly enlarged after the passage of the Internal Revenue Act of 1862, loyal to him personally, rather than to the administration. He didn't even protest when the secretary made heavy-handed efforts to woo the support of key senators, as when he allowed John Conness of California to nominate the customs collector at San Francisco. But Lincoln couldn't help noticing that whenever he made a decision that offended some influential person, the secretary promptly ranged himself in opposition and tried to persuade the victim that he'd been unjustly dealt with and that things would have been different had Chase been in control. Thus, he leaped to ingratiate himself with Fremont after Lincoln required him to withdraw his hasty proclamation against slavery in Missouri, with General Hunter after his emancipation order was overruled, with General Butler after he was recalled from New Orleans, with General Rosecrans when he was replaced by Thomas, and with the Missouri Radicals after they failed to get the president's endorsement. "I am entirely indifferent as to his success or failure in these schemes," Lincoln told John Hay, "so long as he does his duty as the head of the Treasury Department." For the most part, Lincoln regarded Chase's rather clumsy efforts to promote himself with detached amusement. Generally, he was willing to appoint the secretary's partisans to positions in the Treasury Department, preferring, as he said, to let Chase have his own way in these sneaking tricks than getting into a snarl with him by refusing him what he asks. When he learned that Chase was trying to make political capital out of the removal of Rosecrans, he laughed and said, "I suppose he will, like the bluebottle fly, lay his eggs in every rotten spot he can find." Behind Lincoln's easy tolerance was his recognition that his Secretary of the Treasury would probably make a very good president, and his confidence that he would never have a chance to do so. The president could afford to be confident, because throughout the North his partisans were quietly working to secure his renomination. It wasn't considered proper for a presidential candidate himself to seem to have anything to do with these maneuvers, and Lincoln kept a strict public silence about them. But whenever Republican Party leaders came to Washington, they gained easy access to the White House and were often closeted with the president for hours. Out of these conferences arose the strategy of opening the offensive against Chase in New Hampshire, the state of his birth. When Republicans of the Granite State met in Concord on January 7th, their only stated business was to renominate Governor Joseph A. Gilmore. But young William E. Chandler seized the occasion to rush through a resolution praising Lincoln's unequaled sagacity and statesmanship, and declaring him the people's choice for re-election to the presidency in 1864. Chase's supporters had to be content with the backhanded compliment of a resolution that expressed confidence in the financial abilities of the Secretary of the Treasury, but urged him promptly to detect, expose, and punish all corruption and fraud upon the government. Spurred by the action of New Hampshire, Simon Cameron sprang into action in Pennsylvania. Loyal to a president who had generously accepted part of the blame for his mismanagement of the War Department, Cameron also recognized that Lincoln's renomination would be a blow to the rival Republican faction in Pennsylvania, headed by Thaddeus Stevens. Back in December, finding the president pessimistic about his chances for renomination, Cameron reminded him that when Andrew Jackson sought a second term, his managers outflanked any possible rivals by procuring a petition from the members of the Pennsylvania legislature asking him to run again. "Cameron," asked Lincoln, "could you get me a letter like that?" "Yes, I think I might," replied the wily Pennsylvanian, and he went to work. By January 9th, he'd secured the signatures of all the Republican members of the Pennsylvania House and Senate to a request that the president would allow himself to be reelected. "I've kept my promise," he told John Hay. Promptly, other Republican organizations began to swing into line. Throughout the North, chapters of the Union League, originally formed in 1862 to restore Northern morale, shaken by political and military reverses, came out in support of Lincoln's reelection. The Philadelphia Union League, for example, praised the president for showing himself the leader of a people and not a party. The Trenton Union League declared that he had shown his preeminent fitness for the presidency. The New England Loyal Publication Society, which issued patriotic broadsides distributed to nearly 900 newspapers, broke its rule against taking a position on political contests and published a powerful editorial urging Lincoln's reelection. The union members of the legislatures of New Jersey, Kansas, California, and the territory of Colorado all came out in favor of a second term. With Lincoln's supporters on the move, Chase's backers were forced into the open. They'd begun to organize as early as December 9th, the day after Lincoln issued his amnesty proclamation, when an advisory committee met in Washington to consider plans to make Chase the next president. The core membership included two Ohio congressmen, an Ohio Army paymaster who was in the employ of the Treasury Department, and Whitelaw Reed, the consistently pro-Chase Washington correspondent of the Cincinnati Gazette. Subsequently, it was expanded by the addition of Senator John Sherman and Representative James A. Garfield, both of Ohio, and Senator Samuel C. Pomeroy of Kansas, who felt aggrieved because Lincoln had favored his rival fellow senator, James H. Lane, in the distribution of Kansas patronage. Early in February, the Chase campaign tested the waters by issuing a pamphlet, The Next Presidential Election, which deplored efforts to procure the formal nomination of Mr. Lincoln in state legislatures and other public bodies. "The people have lost all confidence in his ability to suppress the rebellion and restore the Union," the pamphlet continued. "The vacillation and indecision of the president, the feebleness of his will, and his want of intellectual grasp were responsible for the failure of Union armies to crush the rebellion. Mr. Lincoln cannot be reelected to the presidency," the argument ran. "The next Republican candidate must be an advanced thinker, a statesman profoundly versed in political and economic science, one who fully comprehends the spirit of the age. Salmon P. Chase's name wasn't mentioned. It didn't have to be. This secret anonymous attack on Lincoln backfired on its authors. As early as February 6th, Ward Hill Lehman learned of this most scurrilous and abusive pamphlet and warned the president of its existence. When it was circulated in Ohio under the franks of Senator Sherman and Representative James M. Ashley, Lincoln's supporters were already on the alert. The document was so mean and dastardly in its character, one correspondent wrote Sherman, that it'll brand with infamy your character as a statesman and your honor as a gentleman. Another protested this attempt on the part of a few politicians at Washington to turn the people against old Honest Abe, and instructed the senator, "You can't do it, and Mr. Sherman, you need not try it. If you were to resign tomorrow, you couldn't get 10 votes in the legislature. If you can't do anything better, you'd better quit." Undeterred, Chase's backers continued to organize, and in late February, under the signature of Senator Pomeroy, distributed a second circular, again marked private, declaring that the re-election of Lincoln was practically impossible. This time, they frankly announced that Chase, with his record clear and unimpeachable, showing him to be a statesman of rare ability and an administrator of the very highest order, possessed more of the qualities needed in a president during the next 4 years than are combined in any other available candidate. Sent to hundreds of Republicans throughout the North, this Pomeroy circular promptly became a matter of public knowledge. The Washington Constitutional Union published it on February 20th, and 2 days later, the National Intelligencer gave it broad circulation. Once again, Chase found himself in the embarrassing position of appearing disloyal to the president to whose favor he owed his office, and he quickly disclaimed responsibility for the Pomeroy circular. He was, he wrote Lincoln, only a reluctant candidate, and he hadn't been consulted by the friends who were organizing in his behalf. Choosing his words very carefully, he denied knowledge of the existence of the Pomeroy circular before it was published, a statement that may have been literally true, though the author of the document, James M. Winchell, remembered that the secretary was informed in advance of the plan to send it out and fully approved it. Chase offered his resignation, declaring, "I don't wish to administer the Treasury Department one day without your entire confidence." Coolly, Lincoln acknowledged the secretary's letter, promising to answer fully when he could find time to do so, and he left Chase dangling in the wind. Lincoln's aides were furious over the unscrupulous and malicious activities of the Treasury rats, who were out to injure the president. But Lincoln held his peace for a week. Then, in a rare attempt to discuss political questions with Robert, who was home from Harvard for the holidays, he strolled into his son's room one evening and showed him Chase's letter. Calling for pen and paper, the president drafted a reply to the secretary, stating that he did not perceive occasion for a change in the Treasury Department. He hadn't read the Pomeroy circular and didn't think he would read it. He was, however, not shocked or surprised by its appearance, for he'd been aware of Pomeroy's pro-Chase organization for several weeks. "I've known just as little of these things as my own friends have allowed me to know," he assured Chase. "They bring the documents to me, but I don't read them. They tell me what they think fit to tell me, but I don't inquire for more." when Robert asked in surprise if he really hadn't seen the circular. His father replied almost sternly that, though a good many people had tried to tell him something he didn't wish to hear, his answer to Chase was literally true. Before his low-key letter reached Chase, Lincoln had already delivered a different sort of reply. On February 22nd, the National Committee of the Republican Party, which in the forthcoming election was to call itself the National Union Party, met in Washington, and four-fifths of its members, who were mostly federal office holders appointed by Lincoln, expressed support for his re-election. The committee also followed the president's wishes in appointing an early date, June 7th, for the National Convention to be held in Baltimore. The next day, in Indianapolis, where John D. DeFries, the superintendent of the government printing office, had been working, with the president's knowledge and approval, to check the Chase forces, the Indiana Republican Convention endorsed Lincoln's re-election. 2 days later, the president's supporters in the Ohio State Republican Convention rammed through a resolution urging his renomination. Then, on February 27th, in the House of Representatives, Frank Blair, on leave from his Army command by permission of the president, launched a savage attack on corruption in the Treasury Department and placed the blame squarely on Chase. Referring directly to the Pomeroy circular, Blair remarked, "It's a matter of surprise that a man having the instincts of a gentleman should remain in the cabinet after the disclosure of such an intrigue against the one to whom he owes his portfolio." And he speculated, "I presume the president is well content that he should stay, for every hour that he remains sinks him deeper in the contempt of every honorable mind." Sore and unhappy, Chase withdrew from the presidential contest on March 5th, on the grounds that his home state of Ohio had expressed a preference for another candidate. He sent a copy of his letter of withdrawal to the president. Few took Chase's declination at face value. Playing on the first name of the Secretary of the Treasury, the New York Herald reminded its readers, "The salmon is a queer fish, very shy and very wary. Often it appears to avoid the bait just before gulping it down. And even after it's hooked, it has to be allowed plenty of line and must be played carefully before it can be safely landed." So Chase, it suggested, was still playing with the bait of a presidential nomination, and he would probably leap at it again. David Davis, now an associate justice of the Supreme Court, but still a political advisor to the president, was more blunt. "Mr. Chase's declination is a mere sham, and very ungracefully done. The plan is to get up a great opposition to Lincoln through Fremont and others, and when the convention meets, present Chase again." Inevitably, these political maneuvers affected Lincoln's program for reconstructing the southern states. Always alert to what they perceived as a threat of Caesarism, Democrats immediately saw political implications in the 10% plan. By setting up state governments representing one-tenth of the voters in Arkansas, Louisiana, Tennessee, and North Carolina, the New York World noted, Lincoln could control as many electoral votes as may be needed to turn the scale in the next presidential election. And it reminded its readers that if the president was successful, one voter in Arkansas will exert as much political power as 10 citizens of New York. Governor Horatio Seymour pointed out that under Lincoln's plan, 70,000 men in the reconstructed southern states could cast as many electoral votes as the 16 million residents of New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Missouri, Kentucky, and Wisconsin. But Republicans, in the general applause that immediately followed Lincoln's proclamation of amnesty, initially paid little attention to the political implications of his message. The House of Representatives promptly created a special committee on Reconstruction to devise legislation to carry out the president's plan. Though it was chaired by Henry Winter Davis, a critic of the administration, the committee, throughout January and February, concentrated on a bill introduced by James M. Ashley that largely followed the president's ideas, but also provided for Negro suffrage. But then Republican congressmen began receiving reports on the political activities of the president's agents in the southern states that were under the control of the Union Army. In Tennessee, Andrew Johnson, who'd been serving as military governor since 1862, seemed less interested in building broad-based unionist sentiment than in constructing his own political faction pledged to the re-election of Lincoln. In Arkansas, the president entrusted Reconstruction to General Frederick Steele, whom he advised to cooperate with an irregularly convened constitutional convention, in which it was doubtful whether a single delegate had authority to represent a county. Lincoln was aware that there were doubts about the legitimacy of this Arkansas regime, but he instructed Steele not to worry over legal niceties. If the provisional government abolished slavery, the general could fix the rest. In Florida, learning that some worthy gentlemen wanted to restore a loyal government, the president sent his private secretary, John Hay, with blank books to record the oaths of those who swore allegiance. The effort wasn't successful, for the military force supporting the scheme was defeated at Olustee on February 20th, and Hay was unable to gather the 1,400 signatures required to make up 10% of the state's 1,860 voters. To Lincoln's critics, these moves suggested that the chief executive was trying to use the military to set up governments that would support his own re-election. Louisiana provided the real test, both of presidential intentions and of congressional perceptions. It was more important, both strategically and diplomatically, than any other southern state, yet conquered by the Union armies. Situated at the mouth of the Mississippi River, it offered the best launching pad for Union military expeditions against Texas and other regions under the control of Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith, and it could also be a base for operations against Mobile. With its French and Spanish traditions, Louisiana was better known to Europeans than any other southern state, and New Orleans, the largest city in the seceded states, was a major port. If Louisiana could be made a showcase of Reconstruction, Europeans would receive an inescapable signal of the inevitable collapse of the Confederacy. Ever since Farragut captured New Orleans in April 1862, Lincoln had been hoping for the reorganization of Louisiana as a loyal state and its readmission to the Union. Initially, he hoped that Louisiana Unionists, who claimed to be in a majority, would reassert themselves, disavow the Ordinance of Secession, and return to the Union. But he found them reluctant to take the initiative. They wanted, he said, to touch neither a sail nor a pump, but to be merely passengers, deadheads at that, to be carried snug and dry throughout the storm and safely landed right side up. Consequently, neither Benjamin F. Butler, the Union military commander, nor George F. Shepley, whom the president named military governor of the state, was able to make much progress in persuading Louisianians to return to their old allegiance. But the president continued to push for the organization of a loyal government, pressing Butler and Shepley to register voters and hold local elections. He insisted on prompt action. "Don't waste a day about it," he directed. "Follow forms of law as far as convenient, but at all events, get the expression of the largest number of the people possible." He cautioned that these elections must represent the real residents of Louisiana, not the Union soldiers nor the Northern carpetbaggers in the state. To send a parcel of Northern men here as representatives, elected as would be understood, and perhaps really so, at the point of the bayonet, he informed Shepley, would be disgusting and outrageous. But the results were meager. In December 1862, Butler staged elections in the two congressional districts under federal military control, and Benjamin F. Flanders and Michael Hahn, both of New Orleans, were sent to Washington. Neither represented any sizable constituency. After long debates over their credentials, they were given seats in the House of Representatives just as the term expired. The president hoped for better things from Nathaniel P. Banks, who replaced Butler at the end of 1862. But he gave the general a larger task. Since his Emancipation Proclamation had applied only to the areas still in rebel hands, it had left slavery intact in the most prosperous and populous region of the state around New Orleans. Now, convinced that the war was soon coming to an end, Lincoln was troubled that Louisiana might apply for readmission as a slave state. To prevent that course, he desired Banks to sponsor the creation of a free state government that would end slavery throughout Louisiana. To sugarcoat the pill, he declared that he was willing to accept some practical system by which the two races could gradually live themselves out of their old relation to each other and both come out better prepared for the new. But Lincoln didn't think he had the authority to require the elimination of slavery throughout the state. "While I very well know what I would be glad for Louisiana to do," he wrote Banks, "it's quite a different thing for me to assume direction of the matter." During the first half of 1863, little progress was made in setting up a loyal government in Louisiana, because Banks was preoccupied first with his campaign against Port Hudson on the Mississippi River, and then with a planned expedition against Confederate Texas. In August, Lincoln gave him a strong nudge, urging him to confer with intelligent and trusty citizens of the state, like Hahn and Flanders, and endorsing a plan for Louisiana Attorney General Thomas J. Durant to register eligible voters in preparation for a state constitutional convention. 4 months later, the president found, to his dismay, that nothing had been done. Bitterly disappointed, he told Banks to get on with the job, only to learn that the general claimed that he didn't know he was responsible for reorganizing a state government in Louisiana, and that, besides, whatever moves he'd made in that direction had been frustrated by Shepley and Durant. Firmly, Lincoln reminded Banks that he was the supreme authority in his military district. "I now tell you that in every dispute with whomsoever you are master," he wrote. And to make the point emphatic, he repeated the word master 3 more times in the same letter. Before he received the president's letter, Banks had already begun work to establish a free state government in Louisiana. "It can be effected now in 60 days, let me say even in 30 days if necessary, with less public excitement than would attend the enactment of a dog law in one of the eastern states," he promised Lincoln with his usual over-optimism. In his newfound zeal, Banks decided to take a shortcut. Instead of calling a convention to draw up a new constitution for the state, he decided that the only speedy and certain method of accomplishing the president's objective was to hold elections under the antebellum Louisiana Constitution, merely declaring that all provisions in that document relating to slavery were inoperative and void. This was not the procedure Lincoln had suggested, nor was it the process favored by Thomas J. Durant and other members of the Free State General Committee. In their view, the entire state constitution needed revision, not merely to eradicate slavery, but also to eliminate inequities in representation that had favored the planter class. They pointed out that under Banks's proposal, voters would only be required to swear to accept the Emancipation Proclamation, which left the institution of slavery intact in much of Louisiana. In that event, they warned, there's nothing to prevent the continuance of this as a slave state if the pro-slavery party get control. But Banks justified his course to the president as one far more acceptable to the citizens of Louisiana than submitting the question of slavery to an election, since their self-respect, their amour propre, will be appeased if they're not required to vote for or against it. Lincoln approved Banks's decision and urged him to go right ahead with the election of 7 state officers planned for February 22nd. Durant, Flanders, and others in the Free State General Committee were unhappy with Banks's action, but their objections carried little weight with him, since Durant, their principal spokesman, had originally been a very conservative unionist who once complained that the presence of Union troops in Louisiana disrupted the relationship between masters and slaves. The president failed to see an enormous difference between Banks's program of holding state elections before holding a constitutional convention and the Free State Committee's plan for choosing a constitutional convention before holding state elections. Besides, Lincoln was always loyal to his subordinates when they were attempting, however awkwardly, to carry out his wishes, and he could hardly disavow Banks's actions after having repeatedly urged him to move. Lincoln watched with some satisfaction as the election came off smoothly enough on February 22nd, with the participation of about 11,000 voters who'd sworn to support the Union and the presidential proclamations concerning slavery. Hahn, Banks's candidate, was chosen governor over both Flanders, the candidate of the Free State Union men, and J.Q.A. Fellows, a conservative. Jubilantly, the general reported to the president, "The change that has occurred in this state since January 1863 is without parallel in history." And he promised that Louisiana would now become one of the most loyal and prosperous states that the world has ever seen. Lincoln probably discounted Banks's enthusiasm, but he was encouraged by these developments. He thought the setting up of a free state government in Louisiana, to be followed shortly by a constitutional convention, marked an important step in the restoration of that state to the Union. But only an initial step. He wasn't entirely happy about the victory of the more conservative wing of the Free State movement, and he was sensitive both to the demands of justice for the newly freed blacks and to the pressures from their abolitionist allies in the North. Even while congratulating Michael Hahn as the first Free State governor of Louisiana, he asked whether some of the colored people, as, for instance, the very intelligent and especially those who've fought gallantly in our ranks, should be permitted to vote. That would help to keep the jewel of liberty within the family of freedom. But hesitating to overstep his constitutional powers, he offered this advice only as a suggestion. Many Republican congressmen looked on developments in Louisiana with suspicion. Anti-slavery men already distrusted Banks because he'd set up a labor system in Louisiana that allowed plantation owners to employ former slaves as sharecroppers who would receive 1/14 of the crops produced. With restrictions on the movement of freedmen, the system seemed to many Northern observers only a slight improvement over slavery. Republican congressmen heard regularly from disaffected Free State Union leaders about Banks's plans for reorganizing the state government, and Durant warned them that the general adhered to the absurd and despotic doctrine that the fundamental law of the state is martial law, that is, the caprice of a military officer. Sensitive to the interests of the more radical Republicans in Congress, Free State General Committee leaders raised the issue of Negro suffrage as a weapon in their war against Banks. Unaware of Lincoln's private interest in this matter, they publicly proposed enfranchising the free men of color of Louisiana, that is, those blacks and mulattoes who had been free before the war, but not the general population of freedmen. While Banks believed this question could wait until other more pressing issues were resolved. Inescapably, Northern Republicans came to recognize the political implications of the Reconstruction efforts Lincoln was promoting in the South. Once these states were reorganized and recognized, they'd be eligible to send delegates to the Republican National Convention and to cast their electoral votes in the next presidential election. The factional lines among Unionists in the southern states weren't always clear. But in general, those who favored a reorganization under the presidential plan were likely to be Lincoln supporters. In Louisiana, for instance, one conservative rejoiced in the election of Michael Hahn as a triumph over Mr. Chase and all his faction, which would send our worthy president the message that the people of Louisiana were willing that the state should be free, but they cannot stand radicalism. Consequently, those Republicans in Congress opposed to Lincoln's renomination took the lead in attacking the government set up under the president's plan of Reconstruction as a way of blocking the renomination of Lincoln. Angered by the president's failure to support him in his fierce battle against the Blair faction in Maryland politics, Henry Winter Davis, by late January, concluded that Lincoln is thoroughly Blairized, and publicly showed his animosity by proposing a resolution in the House. There is no legal authority to hold any election in the state of Louisiana, and any attempt to hold an election is a usurpation of sovereign authority against the authority of the United States. On February 15th, he introduced a measure in the House designed to replace Ashley's bill, which had generally followed the president's plan of Reconstruction. Davis proposed giving a major role in the process of Reconstruction to the Congress, not the president. A little later, he denounced the president's efforts to organize a hermaphrodite government, half military, half Republican, representing the alligators and the frogs of Louisiana. The timing of Davis's outburst was significant. It occurred just 4 days before the publication of the Pomeroy Circular, urging Chase's candidacy for the presidency. Accurately concluding that the Maryland representative was now an active friend of the Secretary of the Treasury, Lincoln saw clearly that the fate of his Reconstruction plan depended on the outcome of the race for the presidential nomination. In turn, that contest would depend on the success of the Union armies, and in the winter of 1863-64, the outlook for the Lincoln administration was bad. In the East, ever since Gettysburg, the Army of the Potomac and the Army of Northern Virginia seemed to be doing a slow dance. In the West, after the brilliant victories at Lookout Mountain and Missionary Ridge, the Union armies remained largely idle for the next 6 months. At the same time, the strength of the armies was dwindling through death and desertions, and there were virtually no new volunteers. On February 1st, Lincoln felt obliged to order a draft of 500,000 more men, and on March 14th, he directed the conscription of 200,000 more. In these grim months, a streak of ruthless determination, not hitherto noticeable, began to appear in Lincoln's character. It wasn't manifested toward the private soldiers in the army, for he was even more considerate than usual of what he called his leg cases, men who, he said, couldn't help running away because God had given them a cowardly pair of legs. But in other actions, he betrayed his sense that the war had gone on too long, with too much loss of blood and treasure, and it was time to force it to a close. His impatience was in evidence as early as September, when he threatened to jail and exile judges who used the writ of habeas corpus to interfere with the draft. Only with difficulty did Chase and other cabinet members persuade him simply to announce the suspension of the writ throughout the country. Outraged when the Confederacy threatened to shoot captured Negro soldiers, Lincoln issued an order of retaliation. "For every soldier of the United States killed in violation of the laws of war," it read, "a rebel soldier shall be executed. And for every one enslaved by the enemy, a rebel soldier shall be placed at hard labor on the public works." It was an order that pleased many Northerners, horrified by reports of Confederate brutalities toward Union prisoners. For instance, the widow of Horace Mann urged the government to "call out from our prisoners of war the most valuable officers and shoot or hang them," and she reported that Ralph Waldo Emerson shared her views. But Lincoln's order remained an empty threat, even as he continued to fume over mistreatment of Northern prisoners. In time, he came to reject retaliation because, he wrote Stanton, "blood can't restore blood, and government shouldn't act for revenge." Out of this frustration, and out of his growing sense that something had to be done to break the military stalemate, arose the plan for a daring raid against Richmond. It originated with the son of Admiral Dahlgren, Colonel Ulrich Dahlgren, a longtime favorite of the president. Though this young man had lost a leg in battle, he was vigorous and ambitious, and he convinced Lincoln that a two-pronged cavalry raid, with a larger force led by General Hugh Judson Kilpatrick, and a smaller troop under his own command, could swoop behind the Confederate lines attack Richmond simultaneously from the east and the west, break through its defenses, and reach the infamous Belle Isle prison, where many Union captives were held. The ill-fated expedition got underway on February 28th. Both forces were repulsed on the outskirts of Richmond, and Dahlgren was killed. On his body, Confederates claimed they discovered papers that showed Dahlgren planned, after releasing the prisoners, to destroy and burn the Virginia capital, pledging not to allow the rebel leader Davis and his hateful crew to escape. High-ranking Union officers immediately, but not altogether convincingly, denied the authenticity of these documents, and they couldn't be linked to Lincoln. But Dahlgren's raid did reflect the president's determination to take whatever steps were necessary to end the rebellion. The president saw little evidence that the commanders of the Army of the Potomac shared his sense of urgency. Throughout the fall and into the winter, Meade engaged Lee in an elaborate campaign of feints and maneuvers. But nothing came of the sharp clashes at Bristow, Kelly's Ford, and Mine Run. Unimpressed by Meade's strategy, the president told him bluntly on the eve of one of these engagements, "Only be sure to fight. The people demand it of the Army of the Potomac." But Meade was not about to seek a head-on collision with the Army of Northern Virginia. With growing exasperation, Lincoln kept prodding him, and he even made him a kind of no-lose offer, promising that if Meade would attack the enemy with all the skill and courage which he, his officers, and men possess, the honor will be his if he succeeds, and the blame may be mine if he fails. But the general didn't rise to the bait. Aware that the president and Halleck still felt that he'd permitted Lee to escape after Gettysburg, he now sought to avoid further mistakes. Instead of taking the initiative, he allowed his campaigns to be micromanaged from Washington. If he suggested taking the offensive, he was informed that the president was unwilling he should now get into a general engagement on the impression that we here are pressing him. If he proposed a defensive strategy, he learned that the president thought he was throwing away his advantage in numbers over the Army of Northern Virginia. His plan to push Lee's army back into its entrenchments at Richmond drew the president's blunt comment, which none of his commanders seemed able to understand. Lee's army, and not Richmond, was its objective point. Inevitably, Lincoln began to contrast the lethargy of the Army of the Potomac with the extraordinary energy demonstrated by the Western armies under Grant and Sherman. Failing to recognize that no small part of the success of these generals stemmed from the inability of the president, the secretary of war, or the chief of staff to interfere with the execution of their plans. When Lincoln learned that Meade had allowed Longstreet's army, which had been fighting in eastern Tennessee, to retreat into western Virginia without molestation by Union forces, he exploded in anger. If this Army of the Potomac was good for anything, if the officers had anything in them, if the army had any legs, they could move 30,000 men down to Lynchburg and catch Longstreet, he exclaimed. Can anybody doubt if Grant were here in command that he'd catch him? Still, he wasn't yet ready to bring Grant in from the west. One reason was that the general was beginning to be talked about as a possible presidential candidate in 1864. He was a favorite of the influential New York Herald, and since his political views were unknown, he was wooed by both Democrats and Republicans. With General McClellan conspicuously courting the Democrats, Lincoln wasn't about to appoint another general-in-chief who had political aspirations. And he asked E.B. Washburn, the representative from Grant's district, to report on the general's political ambitions. Washburn referred him to J. Russell Jones, a close friend of Grant and his investment advisor, who brought to the White House Grant's letter pledging that nothing could persuade him to be a candidate for president, particularly since there was the possibility of re-electing Lincoln. "You'll never know how gratifying that is to me," the president said after reading the letter. "No man knows when that presidential grub gets to gnawing at him just how deep it'll get until he's tried it. And I didn't know but what there was one gnawing at Grant." With that obstacle removed, Lincoln enthusiastically backed a measure in Congress to create the rank of lieutenant general, unused since the days of George Washington, and he promptly appointed Grant to that rank. Summoned east, Grant arrived in Washington on March 8th, just in time for the weekly White House reception. He'd lost the key to his trunk and had only his rough traveling uniform, which was a good deal the worse for wear. But he decided to go anyway, since it had been reported that he might put in an appearance. Arriving at the White House, the general made his way through the throng of buzzing visitors toward the tall figure of the president. When Lincoln spotted this medium-sized, unobtrusive, inconspicuously dressed man, he greeted him warmly, saying, "Why, here's General Grant. Well, this is a great pleasure, I assure you." Lincoln introduced the visitor to Secretary Seward, who in turn presented him to Mrs. Lincoln. A few minutes later, Grant was led into the crowded East Room, and so many people pressed to greet him that he was obliged to stand on a sofa to prevent being trampled while he was shaking hands. It was at least an hour before Grant, flushed and perspiring, was able to return to the president. Lincoln reminded him of a brief ceremony the next day when he'd receive his commission as lieutenant general. Aware that Grant wasn't used to public speaking, he gave the general a copy of the remarks he intended to make and considerately suggested that Grant might want to write out his response, which could include a statement to put him on as good terms as possible with the Army of the Potomac and obviate the jealousy of other commanders. Determined to get good publicity from the occasion, Lincoln summoned all his cabinet officers for the brief ceremony at the White House. At 1 o'clock, Stanton and Halleck escorted Grant into the president's office, where Lincoln presented the general with his commission and made a brief speech. "With this high honor devolves upon you also a corresponding responsibility," he reminded the warrior. But he promised, "As the country herein trusts you, so under God it will sustain you." Grant then took a paper from his vest pocket and began reading. But his voice failed. Straightening up, he threw his shoulders back, took the paper in both hands and started again at the beginning and read it through. Accepting the full weight of the responsibilities now devolving on him, he didn't directly address either of the concerns the president had suggested the night before, though he did praise the noble armies that have fought on so many fields for our common country. After that, members of the cabinet were introduced to Grant. Nearly everybody applauded Lincoln's appointment of Grant as general-in-chief of the armies, with Halleck as his chief of staff. Militarily, the new arrangement made a great deal of sense, but it was also politically wise. The New York Herald grumbled that Lincoln had only elevated Grant in order to remove a possible rival for the presidency, though that was unfair, since Grant had made it abundantly clear that he was not and would not be a candidate. Still, with Grant now definitely out of the picture, and Chase at least ostensibly out of the race, Lincoln's prospects improved. The canvass for the nomination is practically closed, ex-Governor Dennison of Ohio wrote the president. No person but yourself is seriously thought of for the succession.
This ends Disc 27.